Today is December 15th. We're here at the JCC Thursday morning learning Jewish thought. This particular year we're learning, of course, the Odyssey and Providence, specifically in Chazal, in the language and the writings of our sages. And we're getting very close to the end of this unit. What we're doing today is a self-contained unit that we may not finish and that we began last time. But I want to give an overview of this unit. The six or seven sources in this unit are all about, at least in my mind, this is the way I classified them, the minimization to some degree or another of hashkacha pratit. The limitation, that is, of the concept of individual divine providence. Almost all the sources we've seen until now, barring those that we saw last time, assume some type of hashkacha pratit, individual providence, and explain if there's individual providence, well, how can bad things happen to good people? And there were so many different answers, that God takes the tzaddikim so they won't see evil, or that God doesn't have that much interest in this world, the real reward is in the next world, and the real punishment is in the next world. Or we really don't understand. Whatever it might be, we saw many, many answers. Satisfying more, satisfying less. But the source we want to see this time go in a different direction. Minimizing to a certain degree hashkacha pratit. Now, let's back up a little bit. The sources we'll see today, first of all, of course, they minimize retributive hashkacha pratit, that is to say, reactive hashkacha pratit, that is to say, you get what you deserve. But even further, they minimize all types of hashkacha pratit. For example, we saw a source of Rabbi Akiva who said that things that happen to you that seem bad are really good. Like the story about him camping out outside the city, he thought that was bad because they didn't give him a hotel room. But it turned out that it was good because that night the city was attacked and he was saved that he wasn't there. Now that's an example that of saying that things we think are bad are really all for the good, but that's about hashkacha pratit, that God made it good for him individually. No, we're putting that aside.
Not for everybody else, they died, so it's okay for him.
But talking now about hashkacha, about limiting hashkacha pratit, and if we see today sources that talk about things being good, things that are seemingly bad being good, we're not talking about good for the individual. We're not talking about God focusing on the individual. We're talking about the system as it is, as a whole, being set up to provide the good for the maximum amount of people. That's what we're seeing today. Let me give a little bit of an example. We're going to see today, perhaps we won't get to it today, but the latter sources in this unit, that minimize hashkacha pratit are about the fact that there's just chance in this world. Bad things happen because they do, or because of some predetermination, like what we today call genetics, but in those days they called mazal, they called astrology, the stars. Or a source that will say bad things happen because we inflict them upon ourselves. But do me finish. But all these sources, whether it's about some type of predetermination, whether it's about things we do to ourselves, or whether it's about chance, what I see the common denominator being is a limitation, minimization of hashkacha pratit.
Are you equating astrology and genetics?
I'm equating them in the sense that they say that there's some force, there's some predetermination that's not necessarily God focusing on you, the individual. Yes. There's some predetermination that determines what happens to you. Yes. That's not related to God's individual decision and not related to your individual decision.
But I've never heard anybody equate astrology and genetics before.
But Jim, yes. Equating just in the fashion I just said.
I know.
But it's not equating them at all.
Right. It's just saying they have a common denominator.
No. Did you say astrology was called mazal, or that?
Yes, I said that.
Is that the? That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
The mazal.
Mazal. Yeah. Mazal means the constellations. Right? Mazal tov means may you have a good constellation.
Oh.
We don't mean it in that fashion when we say it today, right? But that's what it is. So anyway, Those are the latter sources we'll see in this unit that minimize hashkacha pratit. The first sources we'll see in this unit, the first three, which we began last time, are about minimizing hashkacha pratit by saying that the way that God set up the world in general is good for the largest amount of people, even though individuals may end up being hurt or seemingly hurt. And the truth is that all of these sources we're seeing, the first three that talk about the world being set up in a fashion that is good, even though individuals might not experience it as such, and the last three sources that talk about chance or predetermination or self-inflicted wounds, these are the sources that of everything we're seeing are the most meaningful to me. That's my personal opinion.
In the last case, is what a determinism, right?
It's when we say determinism, we usually mean full determinism, right? I'm not talking about full determinism. I'm talking about a certain element of things being set. So these are the sources that are most meaningful to me. And I must say, and I didn't hide this last week, that when we began this unit, began this introduction of things that are especially relevant in my personal religious spiritual life, I found that they fell on deaf ears last week, right? Most of you didn't like them. So everyone has their own taste in theology. That's why I'm so happy that Joe's here today. I hope that he'll be a kindred spirit.
I'm a kindred spirit by definition.
Thank you, Joe. So in this unit, let's review the two sources that we saw last week, and we'll go on to a third that again talks about limiting hashkacha pratit and claiming that the way God created the world is good and it couldn't be better for the klal, even though individuals may not perceive it to be so. The first one we saw was the one that said that Avraham and Yitzhak walked into town and no one could tell the difference between them, and the old man Avraham didn't get the kavod, didn't get the honor due to him because he looked just like his son. So Avraham asked God to make him look old. And that's how old age came to the world. And in my mind, again, this wasn't too well received last week, but in my mind there's a very, very deep message here. That people get old, which implies they become infirm, and they don't look young anymore, and eventually they die. All that we perceive to be bad, but it's actually something that has a benefit. So the benefit in this particular case, of course, is distinguishing between those who have more life wisdom and those who have less life wisdom. But the deeper message, I think, is that many of the things that we view as bad from an individual perspective, if we really look deeper, we would see that on the global level, they have a purpose. Everything has a purpose. And everything is therefore good in the long run, in the larger perspective, even though individuals may experience it as bad. But if we thought deeply, we would ask for those things that we really try to flee. A world without them, world without old age, I mean to say without looking old, would be a very, very perverted world, a very, very difficult world to navigate. And that's, again, only an example, I think, of a general worldview. That was one source we saw last week. And I'm only reviewing one third of that first source, because that was the really important part. And then we got to a second source. All right, everyone has the sheets. At the second source that's at the bottom of the opening page, that there's no need to fold back, so the bottom of the opening page. Oh. And that's the one from Midrash Rabbah, Genesis 9, that said that in Rabbi Meir's Torah, where it says God created everything and he may behold it was tov mod, was very good. So Rabbi Meir, either his Torah said differently or he interpreted it to mean not tov ma'od but tov mavet. Behold, death is good. Death is good. And it's the same basic idea as in the first source, that death, which we perceive to be the ultimate evil, the ultimate downfall for the individual, is in some sense good. And why is it good? Well, the source didn't directly say why it is good. it went on and gave some theories. But in a general sense, I tried to say that a world without death, in which everyone lived forever, would be a world without urgency. Anything could be put off till tomorrow, and till tomorrow, and till tomorrow, and till tomorrow, and tomorrow never comes. Without urgency, nothing would be accomplished. There would be no need to overcome challenges. Everything could be put off. And the very process of doing, overcoming, accomplishing, building would be gone. And of course, this assumes that the meaning of life is in process. And process is destroyed when time is destroyed. And time is destroyed when there's no death. Death creates time in the sense of human consciousness. I just want to tell you a cartoon that I saw many years ago. I think this was in the New Yorker. It's a picture of a guy at his desk, sitting at his desk. There's no papers on the desk. And then in the side, kind of standing over him, is the Grim Reaper, the angel of death, with a sickle in his hand. And the guy looks at the angel of death and said, "Thank God you're here. I never accomplish anything without a deadline." And I love it. That cartoon, unfortunately, captures the meaning of life. Good, Jay wasn't here when I said this because he argued with me all last week.
But you know, it all does make sense. What the argument is that we don't want to personally
die.
Want to admit that we couldn't do anything unless we were threatened with death, or you know that we just don't want to accept that as an individual, but you know for the collective. Society, I see the point.
Yeah. And then there's no need. I'm taking this perhaps further than the source means, but again, I see this source, as I see the previous one, in the framework of limiting the idea of hashkacha pratit. Because the minute you understand that death is good for the collective, and that's the way the world has to be, would be a different world without it, a world not as good, then you don't have to ask the question, why do I die? You don't have to assume that God made me die because of me. No, because I'm part of the world, and in the world, that's the best thing for the world.
How do they reconcile that with the Adam and Eve story?
Let's not get into that. I perhaps don't have an answer, but don't be sorry. It's a good question. I'm just too lazy or too ignorant to give you an answer.
Well, can we flip that and say that in a sense, if Hashgacha Pratit is limited, it can only do so much, then in effect, God is limiting himself, or that God is limited?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ultimately, all these, well, I don't want to give it away, but the answer is yes.
So if I take it one step further, then God allows the processes of nature, whatever you want to call it, to proceed.
Yes. Very good. To put it in the terms of the Rambam, at least translating the Rambam into the modern idiom, what would you prefer? A situation in which your car was always breaking down and you took it to the mechanic and he was always able to fix it, as opposed to a situation in which the car was created in a fashion it never needed a mechanic to begin with? The Rambam says the second situation is obviously the best. Applied to us, a world created in which God doesn't have to intervene for the individual every moment is a better world than one in which he does have to intervene. Rather, it was made good to begin with. That's what we're claiming when we say that in Rabbi Meir's Torah, it says that death is good. Everything the way it was created, even death, and all the other quote-unquote evils, they're all part of something good, and God doesn't have to intervene in individual cases. But only, I see there are two questions. I just want to finish the thought canon where it was good. Harry.
Well, except that, just
during the study of Torah, God intervenes all the time. All through the Torah, God intervenes. But yet, in everyday life, God doesn't appear to intervene when he should intervene. And that's what bothers people.
So I'll just say to that, this theology that claims that less is more, or it's less intervention of Hashkacha Pratit, is actually better and reflects the fact that God made the world as he wants it. This theology, of course, has to face and grapple with what Harry said, that the Torah seems to describe a different world in which God does intervene, not all the time, but very often.
Very often.
And in a word, in just one word, the way some thinkers and Hasidic masters, rare ones, but some Hasidic masters have explained it, is that the world is, that God is allowing us to grow up. At the beginning of history, the Bible, we were children, and God had to take our hand all the time. But he allows us to grow up and to move into the background to allow really the world to function.
The process is even evident in the Tanakh. With, toward the end of the Tanakh, God is already...
Of course, know, God is gradually...
like he, one of the last books of the Bible, Esther, he's not mentioned at all.
Thank you, Chip.
But all during the Judges, it's like a sine curve. 40 years are good, 40 years are bad, because you sinned, you didn't sin, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that we I would call the childhood
which
of the Jewish people.
Gets to be old hat.
But again, it changes, as Chip said, in our day. So,
we're talking about Hashgacha Pratit as being minimized, not eliminated. Are we? Can we? You say that what they're professing to a great extent, and I realize the contradiction here, but that, you know, God created the world, he turned on the switch, and then he went about his business and let it take care of itself, because the way he created it is perfect and it's going to take care of itself.
I think we're moving in that direction, but the reason I'm saying that these sources minimize Hashgacha Pratit and don't eliminate it is because each of these sources is a snapshot. And it's a few sayings of one or two rabbis. If you take the sugya, the passage, in a nutshell, I'm sorry, in a vacuum, and you say, this is the philosophy of that particular rabbi, well, then indeed you have a philosophy that says God doesn't have to be and is not involved daily. But I know that none of these rabbis meant individual passages as their whole life philosophy. They probably, each of them probably said other things at different times that give a broader picture and balance it out. So therefore, I don't want to say that these sources eliminate it, Hashgacha Pratit. I just want to say they minimize it. So because I'm sure that the rabbi speaking here wouldn't want us to take one line and create of it a whole philosophy and say, ah, that's what that one rabbi thought. I'm sure it was much more nuanced. Now, of course, I, as an individual Jew, philosopher, theologian, if I want to build my life philosophy on one line, then that's my prerogative. Right? But I won't attribute it to the rabbi that said it. He was probably more moderate than I am.
It sounds like politics today when you take one line out and then paint.
Look, I'm being recorded. I want to make sure that I'm covering all my bases here.
Regardless of the context.
But it's really true, what I'm saying, I think. So let me just review one idea that appeared in this second source, the one that began that death is good. And we're right in the middle of the back of the first page. And it had said there the following, where in the second line after the footnotes, right where my finger is, the second line in the middle, but the reason is, and why does God have everyone die in this world? But the reason is lest the wicked perform a fraudulent repentance, saying, surely the righteous live only because they treasure up religious acts and good deeds. So shall we too lay up a store of religious acts and good deeds, and as a result, their performance of such would be with ulterior motives. That statement seems very limited. I think it's one of the deepest statements we've read in this class.
Really?
I really do. Because just, and I tried again to sell this to you last week.
This is the hardest one to accept.
But what it says is the following. That if God let the righteous people live and killed the evil doers for the evil deeds in this world, then everyone would see that it's not good to do evil, and everyone would do good. And that would be bad for the world. Why would it be bad for the world?
But it doesn't say that.
Wait a second. That would be terrible for the world, because you wouldn't be able to distinguish between the evil doers, between those who do good for the right reason and those who do good for the wrong reason.
Sincere versus
the covenant.
And, well, why would that not be good? It would be a great world. Everything would be good. There's an assumption here that the meaning of life and the purpose of life is not merely in the external, the physical, the material good deeds and goodness of the world. That the real meaning and the real purpose is inside. Chip just said kavanah, intention. The real purpose of the world, the real meaning of life, this is what's hidden in the statement we just read, is that everything has to do with internal processes of character development and moral growth. Wait a second. A world in which God zapped the evildoers immediately would be a world in which everyone would be forced, quote-unquote, coerced into doing good, and there would be no possibility of developing character. Because I would be forced to do good. I wouldn't struggle. Should I do bad? Should I do good? I would have no urge to give in to my Yetzer Hara, because I know I'd be immediately zapped if I did. So all of the inner life that's all about developing richness and texture of the soul, all growth, all maturity, all the possibility of the development of maturity would be completely gone, and we would all be emotional and moral children. Just imagine a world in which God behaves towards everyone in this room like a parent behaves to a two-year-old, slapping him on the arm every time he does wrong. And doing that when he grows to be 3 and 4 and 5 and 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, you never give him a chance to become himself.
It doesn't say that.
That's what it... Okay.
It doesn't say that.
I think that's what it says.
Well, I don't think it says
that. Okay, so we can agree to disagree.
But
Mo wanted to speak earlier.
I have a problem with the supposition that treasuring up religious acts, the way this says in the translation, that in itself, only doing that, even if in the land of Israel you observe all 613 mitzvot, we still have areas of life which are not covered.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand, and it's the opposite. Mussar is the flip side of that. Mussar says if you will develop good characteristics, you will then follow the mitzvot. That.
Okay.
Instead of the mitzvot create good character.
Yeah, isn't there a saying better that they follow the mitzvot and not believe in me? For through following the mitzvot, they will come to believe in me.
Okay.
Yeah, but
and therefore?
Therefore, the actions are what stresses of the actions.
Right, so this obviously, I think, is a deeper view.
Yeah.
But Rabbi Yonatan, he's concerned mostly with their motives.
Right. The inner world.
I know, but the point is, if you can make a wicked man a better man, the heck with his motives.
What's the definition of better?
Well, what's the difference?
Not an evil doer.
Yeah.
Okay, so in that sense, a child who never does, a two-year-old who never does wrong because his parent is always watching him, he's better than me. Because I sometimes sin.
No. We're not offering comparisons. We're not offering comparisons. I mean, everyone in this room can be a good person, but we're not saying I'm better than him or he's better than me.
Okay, but what's the best world that God should create? Should he create a world in which everyone is a robot?
Not a robot. To be a good person means you're a robot?
I'm saying, again, if God is there watching you all the time, always...
They're watching you
all
the time.
But that's the suggestion. Oh. Why is it not a world in which God zaps you when you do evil?
It doesn't say he zaps you, boom, boom. Where does it say that?
It says it.
Actual English word says that.
Okay, so the first question we asked was... why then was the penalty of death decreed? That's the question. It's right over here.
Yeah, why was the penalty decreed? Go ahead.
And it says, and it gives a certain answer, and then it says at the beginning, right after the footnotes, it says, given your answer, he should have decreed death for the wicked, but not for the righteous. So the question is therefore, why do the righteous also die, and not just the wicked? Then the question is, why do the righteous die and not just the wicked? Why can't we have a world in which God just zaps the wicked? And the answer is everything we just said.
Oh God, maybe it's my interpretation, your use of the word zap. When you zap someone, it's instantaneous. We're not talking about instantaneous death. We're talking about death coming, period.
I think we're talking about what I said because of the answer given. The reason is, lest the wicked perform a fraudulent repentance.
Right.
In other words, we're afraid of a world in which God communicates to you that you did evil and you're zapped.
I think that's where you make the error. The question is, why don't the good people live forever, and why do the wicked people die?
That's true.
Well, what Mo said makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, Mo is right. But it's the same thing as I'm saying. It's the same point. If it's the same point, Harry.
No, it's not the same point. Okay, then. A zap means instantaneous.
So look. Let's go step by step. Mo was very good. Mo's right.
Yeah, I agree with Mo.
So let's see what it means with the scenario that Mo created. Right? So let's say we had a world in which the righteous live forever, and the wicked are killed.
No, the wicked die.
The wicked die.
They eventually die.
Okay.
Forget the word zap.
Okay, so I am, I'm 54 years old.
And all the people in this room live forever.
And I'm looking at a world
right.
in which I see that lots of people live forever. And other people die. And I do my scientific study, and I come up with the conclusion it says here, that the reason some people live forever is because they didn't sin. And the reason some people die is because they sinned. Right? Am I okay now?
Yeah. No, it's not okay because people don't live forever.
But that's what the source, that's a hypothetical situation.
That's what the story says.
Okay.
The story says the problem is the wicked can pretend to be good by following all the mistakes.
But what's the hypothetical situation it's setting up? That... Like Mo said, that the righteous live forever, right?
Yeah.
And that the wicked die, eventually. So if I live in that world, and I open my eyes, and I see what's happening, what do I see? I see that if I am always righteous, I'll live forever. And if I sin, I will die eventually. I won't call it zap. I'll die eventually. What will that lead me to? It will lead me to doing good. Not because I want to do good. Not because I've undergone a process of emotional maturation. Not because I'm struggling with my Yetzirah. I'm doing good because I don't want to die.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, okay, fine. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is a world in which externally everything is good. But internally, we haven't grown.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. We haven't grown. We haven't matured. We're still children. The only way for a parent to allow a child to grow up and mature and become an adult is to allow him freedom, which means not always to punish him, when he does wrong, but to let him make his own decisions. And this is presenting a scenario, a hypothetical scenario, that we all think is so good, but when we think about it deeply, it causes us to remain emotional children, and that would be worse than a world in which you die. Oh, Jay wanted to speak.
Jay's ahead of me. Jay and Martin are both ahead of me.
Oh, then Martin.
This premise, this idea that you've just articulated very well, that
finally,
idea that we had discussed at length some time ago about putting things in your box, your black box, for future reward in the world to come, that would invalidate that entire concept. Because for the very reason that you said, that is one's incentive to get a better life in the world to come.
Good point. Didn't think of that. Good point.
Things in, I mean, what's the difference between that and the evil person wanting to live forever the reward by doing good? So it's,
you're right.
It's a struggle.
Let me reflect what Jay said. See, if I understood, and then we'll go to Martin. I think Jay is saying that not only is reward in this world not conducive to the development of a maturing process, even knowledge of reward in the next world is not conducive.
Same premise, exactly.
Is not conducive. Very good, very good. And you're right. And so with really, the whole concept of reward is not conducive to the free development of a moral personality and to the maturation process as a whole. And if we believe, and you don't have to believe this, but if we believe that the essence of life is in the process of maturation, then ultimately, if there's going to be reward, it has to be hidden from us. Deeply hidden from us.
Or maybe no.
I
agree. Now, what you're saying is fundamental to everything, because just like, okay, just if you're a person and you carry out the various mitzvot, but it's not in your heart, you're just doing, you're checking your box, you're just doing it because I better do it, is meaningless to God. But if you do it because it's in your heart to do it, you know, that has meaning to God.
That is indeed what we're supposing, right? We don't have to, like this Harry. Senior moment.
Harry.
Harry disagrees. And Harry's not the only one that disagrees. Many of the sources we've seen apparently disagree.
But I mean, just going through a laundry list of good works doesn't get you anywhere. It's a matter of, are you carrying out those good works because it's in your heart to do it, or are you just doing it mechanically?
That's what we're saying, but again, you could disagree. Harry does have a leg to stand on. And also earlier, Chip mentioned a Talmudic passage that seems to say, right, that the most important thing is the deed and not what goes into it, not the kavanah, not the intention, not the maturation.
A couple of things. One, this obviously deals with the issue of intent and the importance of intent.
Mm-hmm.
But I have trouble with the constant reference to the parent-child relationship with God. I don't think it's fair to God, and I don't think it's fair to man. Because if we're continually dependent on God,
mm-hmm.
then we never mature.
Right.
That's my point.
Yeah, God kicked Adam and Eve and out of the Garden of Eden, said, okay, buddy, you're responsible now.
And then Eve complained that he referred to her as buddy.
Well, I'm taking the part out that works for me. Okay?
But Mo, don't forget, when you became my misfit, you became a man, see?
Well, that's not
halakha. Look, I agree with Mo, but I would just phrase it differently.
Yeah.
You don't have to, Mo, come out against the metaphor of the parent-child relationship. We just have to remember that part of the parent-child relationship is the child growing up and the parent receding into the background,
right,
and hoping that the child fulfills the values that were taught earlier.
If God goes into the background,
mm-hmm.
then there goes Hashgacha Pratit.
That's my point
for that individual.
That's what you've been saying for the past half an hour, right? Okay, so now...
Wait, what do you mean, that's your point?
My point is that for God to allow us to mature,
right,
to go through the process of becoming, he has to decide to hold his hands behind his back and not slap us when we do wrong.
Right.
Well,
okay?
That leaves a basic issue about who identifies what's wicked and who punishes what's wicked.
Say it again, please.
Who identifies what's wicked and defines what's wicked and who punishes the wicked?
I.
If God doesn't do it, then we do it. Do we do it because we're stronger or more wicked or more just than the wicked?
I think that's an important question, but a different question. How we judge our own deeds as individuals and how society judges deeds.
But God doesn't do it.
According to this approach, God doesn't usually do it. Again, I'm going to hedge my bets. God doesn't usually do it. God doesn't overtly do it.
So God is not a part of our lives.
Well, are my parents at the age when I'm 54, are my parents part of my lives in a certain sense? My parents are all of my life because they gave me what I have. Let's go on. Oh.
But Jim, I think raises a pretty interesting point that just occurred to me. That if it is important for a person to be self-motivated to do things based upon without any inducement such as a reward, that's what we've been saying, that is a good thing, then would it not equally be true that a bad person can do the bad thing by virtue of his nature without any inducement that he's going to get any rewards for doing the bad thing? Wouldn't they be equal?
Because
the punishment for the good doer is death, and for the bad doer is death. There is no distinction with respect to the punishment, because we're all treated equally.
Right.
So a bad person can be true to his inner nature of evilness, and just as a good person can be for his goodness, and they should be treated equally.
Yes. And they are treated equally.
We all die.
No, there's a problem. Why are we regarding death as a punishment? You know, assuming that you're healthy all your life, that you don't go through any surgery.
Right.
Why is that a punishment? Well, is it part of the natural process?
Correct. However, you have to say that if a person lives to 120, that's not a punishment. But for those that are taken, quote, prematurely.
Right. That's a real question. Okay, that's a question we keep struggling with.
Yes.
But this Rabbi Meir seems to say death is not punishment at all.
Right.
And then they go on to explain why the good die along with the wicked, and then they come up with this reasoning, which for most of us, if not all of us, is very difficult to deal with. It sounds like a real stretch. It is a real stretch. But try to find a reason why good people die.
I think we're doing pretty good.
But good people die simply because we have not learned to stop.
We'll get to that. We'll get to a source that says something like that. We're about to get to the first source for today. Until now, it's been reviewed, but this is really good. I feel today we've gotten further and deeper than we got last time. The next source, not only is it in a category of sources I love and relate to, but particularly it's mind-boggling. This source is mind-boggling. Here we are, Midrash on Psalms, edited by Shlomo Buber.
Not Martin.
They were related. I can't remember the relationship between them. I think Shlomo Buber was his grandfather.
This is still a medieval or a modern?
No, this is a Midrash. It's
Midrash
from the period of Chazal.
Yeah.
But it was edited in the mid-1800s.
Okay.
I think it's the grandfather of Martin Buber that edited it. And so it was. Edited, I mean, brought it to printing. I don't mean change the wording. I shouldn't say edited. I should say published. And so it was at the giving of the Torah, when the Holy One, blessed be He, came to give Torah to Israel at Sinai, the angels began presenting arguments to the Holy One, blessed be He, saying, "What is man that thou should be mindful of him? God our Master, how great is your name in all that earth, that you have put your majesty upon the heavens." And they said before him, "Master of the universe, it is more befitting for you to give the Torah here in the heavens, because we are holy and pure, and the Torah is holy and pure. We are alive, and your Torah is the tree of life. It is better that it be with us." In other words, don't give human beings the Torah. It's not for them, it's not fitting. It's for us, not for them. He answered them. God said, "No, I'm going to give the Torah to human beings anyway." He said, "It is not fitting that it be in the upper realms. As it is said, should it not be found in the land of the living? And is there land in the upper realms?" Right? The Torah has to be on the land, and you guys don't have land. "Where should it be? In the lower realms. As it is said, it is I who made the earth and created man upon it." Hey, that was nice, but now comes the fantastic part. Rabbi Nehemia, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, says, "It may be compared to a man who had a son who was missing one of his fingers, and his father sent him to learn flax combing, silk processing, and other similar skills, trades that require all the fingers. After some time, his father traveled to him, where he was being apprenticed, and said to him, to the master craftsman, 'Why did you not teach these skills to my son?'" Because the father saw the son hadn't learned anything all the months he's been an apprentice. He replied, "These skills require all the fingers. Well, your son is missing one finger, and you asked me to teach him flax combing and silk processing?" So said the Holy One, blessed be He, "The Torah cannot be by you, or it's by the angels, because there is no reproduction among you, nor is there impurity, or death, or disease. Rather, all of you are holy. Well, in the Torah it is written, 'If a man will die in a tent,'" and it gives the procedures for the tumah, for impurity. This is the procedure for a leper, tzarat. "If a woman will conceive," and all the matters of reproduction and of generation. "If a woman will have a menstrual flow," all about becoming and pain. And then it says, "This you should eat." It's about the laws of kashrut. It only applies to beings that eat. That is why it says, "Should it not be found in the land of the living?" We have to think about this. So I want to challenge everyone to think for 2 or 3 minutes. This parable of the boy missing the finger, what does it have to do with the message? Or to say it differently, who is the boy without the finger in the larger story?
In mankind. Humankind. That's not complete yet. That because it is incomplete, and what they have to do is, with all these laws, these are ways to attain purity.
So, it's actually deeper than that.
Okay.
Look again at the story. Look again at the story. Who is the boy without the finger in the message? Mo says it's the human beings. But I think that it's actually different.
Okay, if I agree with Mo.
It's okay if you agree with Mo.
Yeah.
Just don't point at him, because something might happen to that finger.
Just think of it as shallow thinking.
Well,
okay.
Could it be the Torah and man adds that missing part and makes the Torah complete?
Could be any man or woman has a disability too.
Because the Torah is, in a way, is written for man.
I hear. But this midrash is so radical, you can't imagine, I think, what it's trying to say. You'll have to go back over and read it.
It couldn't be possibly God who's missing the thing.
No?
That wouldn't.
So I'll tell you, what's going on here? The angels want the Torah.
Right.
And God said it's not fitting for you.
Right.
I have to give it to man, it's more fitting to man. And then Rabbi Nehemiah, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, tells the story of why silk processing is not fitting for the boy without the finger.
Right. Death is the...
So who's the boy without the finger in the story? Not in the parable, but in the overall message.
Oh,
who's
no. Well, the angels.
The angels.
They don't die. They don't,
yeah. We'll read it again.
Yeah.
What it says is that the angels, in not dying, are as crippled as a human being without a limb. You're only complete, you're only fitting to receive the Torah if you have everything that God gives, including death.
Including death.
Including death. Without death in your life, you're like a boy without a finger. It's an amazing midrash. You know how many hours I spent trying to figure this midrash out and translating it? So, the whole story, God says, you know, the Torah is not for you, angels. It's not for the upper realm. I have to give it to men. And then we have this story of the boy missing the finger, and the master craftsman says, I can't teach him the craft because he's missing a finger. The master craftsman is who?
God.
God. God says to the angels, you're missing a finger. I can't give you the Torah. It's not fitting for you.
You're
missing something. But man has a deeper experience. He has the experiences that are described in the Torah, and therefore he can receive the Torah. What are those experiences that man has? He dies. He can become diseased. She can conceive. She has body processes going on inside her. We eat, and we excrete. In other words, we're in a process. And that's the meaning of the land of the living. That we're in a world of process. A world of coming to be, in a world of fading away, and everything is changing and developing. There's dynamism, and that's like having all your fingers. Isn't that an amazing idea?
Amazing.
I'll tell you where I got this source from. I've been preparing these classes for over a year, and I started mentioning my studies on one of the rabbinic listservs that I'm a part of, and I just asked people for sources, and a chaplain sent me this source. Mm. And he told me this is one of the most important sources he uses in his hospice care. It's about realizing, and it's hard for me to say this, I'm embarrassed to say it because I don't think I really can fully accept it, but that death is another element in the richness of a life. And until you have death, until you're willing to accept death, there's something missing from your life. Now, the chaplain uses this on an individual level, whereas really it's stated on a collective level.
Right.
But on a collective level, the human species only has all its fingers when it has all this coming into being, which of course implies also passing away. The process, again, it's all about the process. You need death and you need disease and you need menstruation and you need conception and you need eating and you need excreting. That is life. And without it, we just don't have all the experiences. So if someone says, why do bad things happen to good people? The answer this source gives is, what do you mean by bad things? I mean death, I mean disease. The answer is, on a collective level, that's not bad, that's good. On a collective level, an individual, of course, experiences it to be terrible, painful. But the individual has to accept what is good for the collective. Jay.
Well, I understand, and I'm not quibbling about the basic premise, but I mean the basic idea. But I think that this story, this analogy, is flawed because the Torah was written exactly for man.
Right.
And the angels, who by the own definition in the story, are pure, holy. They don't need the Torah.
Right.
What can they do with it? They have already achieved what man is struggling to do with the aid of the Torah.
Right.
So
Good point. Good point. So I think on the basis of what Jay said, we have to go one step further in understanding the deeper message of the Midrash. So I guess the ultimate message would be that when God wanted to create the world, He wanted to create the best possible world, and He understood that the best possible world is not the one that exists in heaven, which everything is static and there's no character development, there's no process. He decided the best possible world was a world of process.
That's dangerous, though, because if this is the best possible world as compared to the world to come, then we should do everything that we can
to stay here.
To stay here.
You know what? Either you said that last time or someone else said it, something similar. Someone said that if this world of process is so good, well, what's the next world?
Yeah, but
I had an answer for it. My answer was simply, actually, it's not so simple, but okay, I don't have an answer.
No. Okay. No, with that one, you're dealing with the real question: why did God create the world in the first place? But if the process, the thing I sent you, by the way, deals with process.
Absolutely, I read it. It's related to this.
Good.
It's related to this.
Good. But that puts death in one of two possible situations: either as a gateway to the world to come, or either at the completion of the process. Yeah. From this midrash, I don't think it's clear which of the two that is. In other words, that's life, that's it. Or this is now the gateway to the world to come, or to show.
There's no mention of the world to come, and no need for the world to come in this midrash.
Absolutely not.
You could just say in this midrash that the existence of death, in a theoretical collective sense, allows the process. So as an individual, why do I die? So that the next generation could be born.
A demographer or somebody, I'm missing the name. This is a way to make sure there's no overpopulation. There's no what?
Okay, overpopulation.
Well, we took care of that by many instances. By 7 billion people living. Yeah, there's more than all have lived together that mankind can't begin.
Yeah.
This is an Althusian argument. Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking.
But all that tread the globe or the earth are but a something to those that sleep in its bosom. That apologies.
Yes.
Why then, when God is addressing the people from Mount Sinai, He says, I give you life and I give you death. Choose life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We as individuals are commanded, are told to choose life, to do the right thing. Of course we choose life. We want, part of the process that's going on inside of us is doing the right thing and choosing life and trying to live as long as possible.
But that's an interpretation of what the word life means.
In the verse it says, I set before you death and life.
Right.
And death means wrong and life means the mitzvot. That's the context there.
Why did death
in the context.
Wrong? It says there that our life is the length of our days and we will meditate on them.
Right. So Joe is right. That verse seems to say in its simple reading that death is a punishment. And believe it or not, I have it right in my notes. And the chaplain that sent me the source told me that many people bring that verse as a counter to this midrash.
Right.
And it does seem to be a counter to this midrash. I would say, again, this is my personal theology, I would say that that verse represents God's relationship to us when we're children. And when you're children, you have to tell your children if you do wrong, you'll be punished. But you also have to know, as we said, to let up and give them freedom eventually, because otherwise they'll never mature and grow. So God, in the end, recedes into the background and no longer has that verse being something that's hanging over us as a mountain hanging over the Jewish people. Let's see another source. So those three sources we just saw, right, the one about Avram and Yitzchak both looking young and Avram asking for old age, then the source about Rabbi Meir saying that death is good and about Rabbi Yonatan saying that, again, death is good, and now this source about the missing finger, these are the three sources that I most identify with, about, again, the restriction, limitation of Hashkacha Pratit. And now we're going to see a little bit more. In the same vein, these coming sources restrict Hashkacha Pratit, not in the sense we just talked about, because the way God made the world, it's good to have death and suffering, but simply restricting in the sense that there's chance, or there's predetermination, or there's self-inflicted wounds.
What now? It may be good to have death, but why is it good to have suffering?
The same basic reasons.
All right. Explain it then.
Helping us to mature, to overcome things we've talked about again and again and again. And of course, I know that Jim disagrees. He's actually, I mentioned some of this in a class I gave yesterday on Job, and I mentioned Jim's name. I said, Jim disagrees with everything I'm saying here today.
You're infamous.
But you see, it depends on how you define what suffering is. For example, take people in my generation. They were born, you know, they were raised during the times when nobody had any money.
Yep.
Everybody was poor. And so you learn how to do without. You learn how to be frugal, things like that. And you take a lot of, in the modern generation, everything is given, say, to people they're
right.
Not really appreciated because they haven't
right.
Really worked for it.
Right.
So the question is, the fact that you were born poor, and is that a form of suffering? Are we talking about just physical type suffering?
I think you hit the nail on the head. You hit one of the nails on the head.
Yeah.
Yeah. The next source we'll just spend 5 minutes on, I think. It's simple.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's Babylonian Talmud Tractate Yevamot, page 49b to 58. Concerning the number of thy days I will fulfill. In other words, concerning the verse that says, the number of thy days I will fulfill, Tanaim are in disagreement. The rabbis of the Mishnaic period are in disagreement. For it was taught, the number of thy days I will fulfill, that's the verse, refers to the years of the generations. If one is worthy, one is allowed to complete the full period. If unworthy, the number is reduced. So Rabbi Akiva. But the sages say, if one is worthy, years are added to one's life. If unworthy, the years of his life are reduced. I'll go over it again. It's a bit confusing. So this is saying that there's a set amount of time that every person is supposed to live. There's a given. The sages say, if you're worthy on an individual level, you get some more years. And that's the classic thing of reward and punishment, right? You're rewarded for doing good. And if you're unworthy, you lose some years. You're punished. Simple. What does Rabbi Akiva say? Rabbi Akiva said, if you're unworthy, you get some years reduced. And if you're worthy, what happens? According to Rabbi Akiva, if you're worthy, what happens?
You add years.
No, Rabbi Akiva. That's what the sages say. What does Rabbi Akiva say? Yeah. According to Rabbi Akiva, if you're worthy, you don't get years added. You just get the baseline that was meant for you to begin with. Okay, so now let's think about this passage. This passage assumes a certain predetermination. Yeah, before you're born, there's a certain amount of years you're supposed to live. Why? Well, most probably, although the source doesn't say it, most probably it's referring to what they called mazal. Mazal means constellations. In other words, that's the way it's set up. We today don't really believe in astrology, most of us. We have other types of predetermination. We call it genetics. Okay, I'm not saying genetics and biology are the same thing, Jim. I'm just saying that their predetermination was astrology. We have a different type of predetermination in our scientific minds. But both us and they believed in some type of predetermination. So that's point number one, that this source says there's a certain predetermination. There's a certain set fate that you're going to have that's not related to hashkacha pratit. The baseline is not related to your deeds. It's not related to God giving you what you deserve.
The footnote disagrees with you.
I don't think it does.
The span of life allotted to every human being at his birth.
Yeah.
No, so totally consistent with that. Yeah. The span of life allocated to every human being at his birth. And the issue there is whether the worthy ones make sure that you get that span of life by the proper
medical at his birth. That is before you have any deeds, at your birth. So there's some predetermination.
The unworthy who don't do proper, decent medical care and who don't protect the children and who don't do decent dietary, they don't. They die.
Yeah. So the point is, there's a certain predetermination. That's the baseline. And according to the sages, that is upped or lowered according to your deeds. In other words, according to Hashkacha Pratit, it's upped or lowered, but it's still founded upon a baseline that's not Hashkacha Pratit. Wait a second. But what's fascinating is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says that even with the greatest deeds, you cannot overcome the limitations of your predetermination. You hear what I'm saying? According to Rabbi Akiva, if you're predetermined to live 10 years and not more, that's what you live. Even if you're the greatest tzaddik in the world, you can't live more. And if you're predetermined to live 49 years, you can't exceed that. The sages say you can exceed it. But Rabbi Akiva says that the predetermination, whatever it is so limiting, it limits even God, and God cannot give you more, even if you're the greatest, most moral, most upstanding individual in the world.
This is a question, not a statement. This doesn't imply the kind of predetermination there is. For example, is the implication that everybody has the same number, the same predetermined amount of years, or does it imply that each predetermination is on an individual basis without giving the criteria for determining the predetermination? And if it isn't the second, then how do we explain infant deaths?
I think it is the second.
Okay.
I think. The verse that it's quoting from Exodus is in the singular. The number of thy days I will fulfill. Let me make sure about that. It's Exodus 23:26. Exodus 23:26. Yeah, it's in the singular, and I think it means everyone has their own predetermined lifespan. According to the sages, that can be upped or lowered. According to Rabbi Akiva, it cannot be upped.
It's individualized.
In fact, the main thing is 120 years, which is put forth, is proven, being proven by present-day science, that is a predetermined lifespan of a human being. And we just haven't
reached it.
Well, we're getting close. Yeah. Because look at them, people are over 100 right now, which never used to happen.
Yeah, but that's you're saying for everyone.
For everyone,
but
yeah.
You seem to be talking about a predetermined lifespan that's individualized before your birth, according to this source.
120 years is closer.
If you make it generalized for everybody at 120, then how come a infant that has not had the opportunity to sin dies at age 20 minutes.
Because we haven't solved that issue yet. But look how many of them, look at how the infant mortality used to be, was
60%. Okay, good, let's stay back on the subject.
Okay, I have trouble with the number of thy days I will fulfill refers to the years of the generations. Now, I don't understand what that means, because one explanation means that if a generation is 35 years, then everybody's going to live to be 35 years old.
You're saying those words imply a collective predetermination.
I don't know what they imply. I'm confused by that statement.
I was also a bit confused also. And I think it's using the word generation, as the note says, in the sense of lifespan.
Yeah, but is it the lifespan of a generation?
No, it's using the word... Well, I'm guessing. I'm telling you what I think. I'm not sure. It's using the word generations in an uncommon way. Refers to the years of the generations. Refers to the years that each person is allotted for his life. I really... Unfortunately, I'll tell you the truth. If you remember, when we first began this class 7 years ago, I always insisted in bringing the Hebrew and the English. You've seen that in order to save myself time, and in order to save paper, I've begun bringing only the English. What I'm really doing is not the best, because in this situation, we just look at the Hebrew and see what it says. And we can't do that because I didn't bring the source.
Well, it could have been in their respective time of living.
Of each person. That's what I'm claiming. Yep. But again, I understand Mo's question. That's not the usual meaning of the word generations.
Yeah. It could just very simply mean the period of time where you have childbearing, which is what you really refer to as generations.
I think we're talking about lifespan, though, from the context there.
I would read otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. I think Jay was up first, and then Martin. Sorry.
If one assumes that the second point that Joe made, that
yes.
each individual is assigned an unknown but defined mm-hmm. length of time.
Mm-hmm.
What this class is, let's say we accept that without any need for verification. We don't know what it is, but it's there. But what we're struggling with is what the other thing that Joe implied is that this is a time span, but we're struggling with what happens, why is it that that person who has a time span, whether it's 10 minutes or 100 years, succumbs prior to that?
Right.
That's what, to me, the struggle mm-hmm. is, in which it seems to go against whatever the good it is for that person to fulfill his destiny, you might say, for his length of years.
If it's predetermined, how do you know it's prior?
Well, that's of course... the reason that this is, I think, a weak argument, because we don't know what that is. And if whatever happens, we can say, that must have been it.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't it.
Right. Right. So, but this source does say that there are people who don't live out their predetermined lifespan, and that's because of reward and punishment. That's what the source says. I was just bringing the source to say that even a source that believes in reward and punishment admits that reward and punishment is only after a given... that's not related to your moral stature. And certainly Rabbi Akiva believes that your moral stature, your deeds, reward and punishment, plays a relatively minor role, because you can never ever, even with the best deeds, exceed your predetermined lifespan. So that's why I put the source in the framework of those sources that limit to a certain degree the idea of hashkacha pratit.
That's during a time period where people felt when they died it was predetermined, as opposed to the way we think now, wherein we solve these problems of heart attacks, of cancer, and as such we do not in our society accept the fact that a person had a predetermined period.
Okay, I'm not telling one of you to accept that, on a philosophical level we're exploring ideas that we can apply in different fashions. First, Martin wanted to speak.
I think, well, reading the passage, I guess the impression I got is that, you know, yes, a lifespan is allotted to each human before his birth, but maybe in relationship to the years of the generations. In other words, if you're born during the Middle Ages and the average of that generation of lifespan was this versus, say, someone born in the 19th century or the 20th century, the 21st century, it seems like, yes, you're allotted something, but maybe in relationship with relation to the generation that you're born into.
That's a fascinating idea. Okay, yeah. I can't say
too
much.
But Rabbi Akiva's life and many of his colleagues was certainly shortened by virtue of his life experience.
From his burning mistake.
Exactly.
That, sure.
So... and I mean, he's saying it now, but
On the other hand,
I'm wondering if you, I mean, he, his life, he was a young, still a young person at that time.
By the way, Rabbi Akiva was martyred about the age of 80.
Oh, 80.
He lived a long, long life and then was martyred, isn't it?
We're saying that this is an example of the diminishing of Hashkas, of critique.
In my opinion.
But if we're saying that there is a predetermined lifespan prior to birth or at birth on an individual basis.
Ah, you're tripping me up. Oh, very good. You're tripping me up into my own language. You're right, Jeff.
So it's kind of a mixture. Maybe this is your out. You can say that's why it's a diminishing of, not an elimination of.
Okay, so you technically got me.
Not him.
No, you got me, not him. It's my classification. Oh. But I'll have to explain. What I meant, when I meant Hashgacha Pratit, I meant Hashgacha Pratit, that is a directing of your life by God based on who you are and what you've done with your life. Another source, okay? This source that we're about to see is absolutely strange. Absolutely strange, but it opens up the door to a new avenue of thought. And this source is from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Hagigah, pages 4b to 5a. Rav Yosef, when he came to the following verse, wept. And the verse is, but there is that is swept away without judgment. People die without judgment. In other words, without God deciding that you should die, they just die. That's what the verse seems to say. He said, is there anyone who passes away before one's allotted time? What he means is, does anyone die when it's not God's will for him to die? Does anyone die without God's judgment? Yes. That yes is powerful. People die when it's not God's will that they die. As in the story heard by Rabbi Bar Abaye, who was frequently visited by the angel of death. That's not that the angel of death came to kill him, but he had a dialogue with the angel of death, and he got some inside information. Once the latter said to his messenger, in other words, once the angel of death said to his messenger, go bring me Miriam, the woman's hairdresser. Now, go kill that woman. It's her time to die. God's decided and God told me to get her. He went and brought him Miriam, the child's nurse. In other words, the messenger made a mistake and killed the wrong person.
Wrong Miriam.
In other words, this source says that sometimes people die in this world because in God's bureaucracy there was a mistake.
Right. Is that why we don't name our children after living people, right?
That's an interesting.
Why?
Among the Ashkenazi Jews.
Right. They don't name
them. They don't name their children after living people.
Because we're afraid of?
Because when the Malach HaMavish comes, he'll keep them called.
Really? And that's the reason?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
That's right. And you can't marry.
I was taught that.
Really?
No.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't marry somebody who's got the same name as one of your parents either.
And you see, in my family, there were three Harrys. I'm serious.
No, but you
three Harrys of living Harrys?
Yeah.
No. It's
really?
And we're all named after them.
Yeah, you're all named after Saint Grandfather. No, you can't be named after a living relative.
I know that, but the reason Harry just gave...
Was you taught that as a boy?
No, that's why.
I said the reason that Harry just gave, I'd never heard. And it fits in exactly to this passage. Yeah, thank you very much. No, I want to really write that down.
That's common knowledge.
Wait a second. Look...
But it's not Sephardi.
It's not Sephardi, right. In my wife's family, my father-in-law is now deceased. When he was alive, already had three grandchildren named after him. Yeah. So I'm just going to write this down.
He wasn't Ashkenazic, that's for sure.
Right. Harry's story. Why we...
You had a mixed marriage.
Kids, you
picked
up a footnote.
After relative. So let's go on with the story. said he to him, it said the angel of death to his messenger, I told you Miriam, the woman's hairdresser. He answered, the messenger said, if so, I'll take her back. I'll revive her, and everything will be okay. Said he to him, said the angel of death to the messenger, since thou hast brought her, let her be added. In other words, put her with the rest of the dead. She's already here.
Why would you say that?
Let's not complicate things. But how were you able to get her? So it looks like that's what the angel of death is saying to his messenger, right? Since she wasn't supposed to die, how were you able to do something in the world that's against God's will? Says the angel of death to his messenger. How did this work? So the messenger says she was holding a shovel in her hand and was heating and raking the oven. See, skip the footnotes, right? She took it and put it on her foot by mistake and burned herself. Right? Thus, her luck was impaired and I brought her. Somehow, because she was ill, I was able to zap her, even though it wasn't her time. And she was hurt from the burning rake. Said Rabbi Barabai to him. So now, this whole story was heard by Rabbi. The angel of death told him the story, and Rabbi has a question. And the question is, have ye permission to act thus? Does it really happen that you kill people accidentally and you don't have to give them back? You don't have to resuscitate them, you shouldn't keep them with the dead even though they're not supposed to die? There's no reason for them to die? He answered him, this is what the angel of death said, is it not written, there is that is swept away without judgment? Look, things happen in this world without God's judgment. In other words, there's accidents that happen. He countered. So Rabbi says to the angel of death, I can bring you a different verse. But behold, it is written, one generation passeth away, another generation cometh. And somehow that verse is supposed to imply that a generation doesn't die until its time comes. And generation in the sense of individuals. Right? Going back to our discussion earlier of the word generation. So Rabbi wants there to be justice in the world, that people only die when it's time, but the angel of death says, no, no, sometimes accidents happen. It's a big bureaucracy. What do you want? We make some mistakes. He replied, so the angel of death says, I can live with that pasuk, with that verse. Why? I have charge of them till they have completed the generation, and then I hand them over to Duma. Duma is the chief angel of death. So we have here three levels of angel of death. We have Duma, who's the chief angel of death. And then we have the angel of death we've been talking to. Then we have the angel of death's assistant. So what the angel of death, the second level here, says is, you know, you're right. People really can't die until their time has come. And therefore, when I kill them accidentally, I keep them in storage until their time to die comes. And then I hand them over to the chief angel of death. Like, it's kind of off the books. It's off the books then.
Double bookkeeping. Okay.
No, that's strange bookkeeping.
He then asked him, so this is what Bibi Barabai says to Angel of Death, but after all, what do you do with her years? In other words, she died early, so there's years left in the world that should have been for life, but she's dead. He replied, if there be a rabbinic scholar who overlooks his hurt, I shall give them to him in her stead. If there's someone, there's a Talmid Chacham, a rabbi, who did a really good deed by overlooking his dishonor, right? Someone embarrasses you, someone shames you, and you're able to hold back and not become angry, not express it. Well, for that great deed of restraint, you get the extra years of the person who died inadvertently. That's the end of the passage.
So this second level angel of death has the authority to add to and reduce somebody's life.
That's it. That's
not
like.
Even the top level, and right. It's not God.
Yeah.
It's just a bad translation, but why does it say in her stead?
Because we're talking about a woman who died accidentally, Miriam.
Right.
All
right. So well, from the way we learned before, they might as well just have given it to the bad guy the extra years. Because he's just fulfilling his own destiny as opposed to the studious person that we, this implies that because he was a good religious, good person, that he gets a reward.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So anyway, of course, it's a fascinating story, and of course, it's strange, but it allows for the possibility that people die
accidentally,
for no reason.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
Wrong time, yeah. Right. And in that sense, I put it in the category of different Talmudic passages in Midrashim that limit the idea of Hashgacha Pratit.
Yeah, that's because the messenger didn't check his list before he took his action.
Yeah. And I have a few more sources in the same direction, each one with its own idiosyncrasies. Here's another one. The one we're about to read is the one that Rav Mori Schwartz bases his theodicy upon. If you remember, Mori Schwartz
yes.
is the curriculum director of the Melton program. He lives in Hashmonaim in Israel, and he commutes to Hebrew University, where the Melton program is situated. And he comes to Dallas once or twice a year to see how the Melton program is doing and to do in-service teaching for the teachers in the Melton program. So I've got to meet him. And also turns out that my kids and his kids are actually friends. So the last time he was here, or was it two times ago, the book fair, the Dallas yes. book fair, sold his book, which is called Where's My Miracle? Which is a book about, as I've mentioned, about the Odyssey and Providence. And near the second half of... In the second half of the book, when he begins to present his own personal answers after he gives all the other approaches, he bases his understanding on this very out-of-the-ordinary passage in the, not the Babylonian Talmud, but the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, or the Talmud of the Land of Israel, Tractate Shabbat, Chapter 14, Halakha 3. Rav and Rav Chiya the Great, both of them said that 99 die by the eye and one dies by the hand of heaven. Rabbi Hanina and Shmuel, both of them said that 99 die through exposure to cold and one by the hands of heaven. Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman said in the name of Rabbi Yonatan that 99 die by heat wave and one by the hands of heaven. And the sages said that 99 die as a result of negligence and one by the hand of heaven.
This is a very unique passage because all of these rabbis agree on one part.
It's unique in that sense.
Very little to do about it, right?
Yeah, the point is that God has very little to do with most of the death in this world. The only question we'd ask here is, what does it mean, die by the eye? And one possibility is, the eye means human greed and human lust. Human desire.
Or human failings.
By extension, human failings.
Or the fact that we don't know how to prevent some types of disease yet. Or deaths.
That, of course, is implicit, what you're saying here. And I knew Jim would like this one.
You said by the eye mean implies?
The greed of
greed.
The eye. Desire. The tenth commandment.
Covet. Okay.
Right. Not, of course, we should understand that in the context of the whole passage. It doesn't mean that God punishes you directly for your lust or your desire. It means that we bring it upon ourselves.
Yeah. It leads you to die early.
It leads you to die early.
Our child dies because we have not yet learned to prevent that death.
Now, this source, of course, is pretty unique. The vast preponderance of the sources that deal with providence and theodicy in the Talmud and Midrash don't take this approach, but they talk about everything we've seen until now, all the different ways of understanding the factors involved in God's Hashgacha Pratit. But this source is one of a few that seems to go in a different direction, limiting Hashgacha Pratit, as we've seen in the context of the others as well. Let's look at a last source for today, and it's in the sheets that I gave out at the beginning of today, which means that Carol Ann and Harry don't have it. So I said at the beginning, I guess we three, at the beginning of our class, that this sheet replaces the last piece of paper, and what does you get rid of the last piece of paper? You get rid of the one that has the Yalkut Shimoni at the top, and you put the sheet that I'm giving you. The sheet I'm giving you has the Yalkut Shimoni also, but has something else that's added before that. Now, the source we're about to see is a source that I learned when I was 20 years old, and it made a deep impression upon me. And it was taught to me by a man whose name should be mentioned, because that man has just celebrated his 80th birthday with a whole week of festivities in Israel. This is the famous philosopher and rabbi, Rabbi David Hartman. I just saw a big interview with him on the internet, and he hasn't changed a bit.
Which means what?
That means he has the same power and rage against people who don't agree with him that he had at the age of 40.
Okay. He's not like you, that's for sure.
He's not like me, no.
You studied under him?
I studied with him. So it says here in the Babylon and Talmud Tractate Avodah Zarah, page 54b. The elders in Rome were asked, in other words, the Jewish representatives to the Caesar, if your God has no desire for idolatry, why does he not abolish it? Said the gentle philosophers to the Jewish leaders. They replied, if it was something unnecessary to the world that was worshipped, he would abolish it, he would destroy it. But people worship the sun, moon, stars, and planets. Should he destroy this universe and account the fools? They said to the elders, if so, he should destroy what is unnecessary for the world and leave what is necessary for the world. They replied, if he did that, we should merely be strengthening the hand of the worshippers of these idolaters. Because they would say, be sure that these are deities, for behold, they have not been abolished, they have not been destroyed. And if God destroyed many things, but left the things they worship, they'd say, ah, look, these things must have power. Now, of course, the elephant in the room in this source is, so why doesn't God just destroy the idolaters?
That's a good idea. We'll give them a chance to do teshuva.
There's that, right, there's a hidden assumption here. That God wouldn't want to do that because that would destroy process. That would destroy the possibility of sin and of repentance from sin. It would destroy free will. And it goes back to the thing we said today. Right? That God doesn't just zap the evildoers. Now the Gemara on this Mishnah, our rabbis taught, philosophers asked the elders in Rome, if your God has no desire for idolatry, why doesn't he abolish it? They replied, if it was something of which the world has no need that was worshipped, he would abolish it. But people worship the sun, moon, stars, planets. Should he destroy the universe to count the fools? That's all quoted from the Mishnah. But now it adds a word, a sentence. The world pursues its natural course. And as for the fools who act wrongly, they will have to render an account. Which means in the next world. But the point is that God wants the world to pursue its natural course. That is nature, that is the way it's been established. It's good the way it is. God doesn't have to bring it to the garage to be fixed. He wants it the way it is. We want people to be able to be fools if they so choose. Another illustration. Suppose a man stole a measure of wheat and went and sowed it in the ground. I can just remember David Hartman screaming at the top of his lungs teaching us this passage. He's such a passionate guy. Suppose a man stole a measure of wheat and went and sowed it in the ground. It is right that it should not grow, but the world pursues its natural course, and as for the fools who acted wrongly, they will have to render an account. Another illustration. Suppose a man is intercourse with his neighbor's wife, adultery. It is right that she should not conceive, but the world pursues its natural course, and as for the fools who act wrongly, they will have to render an account. We would want a world in which stolen wheat doesn't grow. And women who commit adultery with their lovers, they don't get pregnant, because why should the child suffer? We want a world of justice. And the word used here, when it says that it is right, deen, it's just, it's what we desire. But God desires something else. God doesn't desire a world in which the evil are immediately punished. He doesn't want a world whose configuration would force you to do good. Right? If you stole wheat and it didn't grow, well, no one would steal wheat. If you stole a toy and it didn't work, you wouldn't steal toys. If you stole a computer and it blew up in your hands, no one would steal. Great. No, terrible. That would be a terrible world. It's a world of zapping that I've been talking about all the time. There'd be no possible for true disinterested service of God, no possibility for real deep morality, because everything would just be coercion. So God created a world that pursues its natural course, which means that there is little hashkacha pratit, certainly not hashkacha pratit, of the retributive fashion, of the reactive fashion, because God wants free will. Why do bad things happen to good people? Because God gave us free will, and God believes, apparently, that a world of free will is better than a world of everyone acting automatically righteously. And in the world of free will, bad things happen to good people, because people make bad choices, or because of the very nature of who we are, and the way we're, there has to be process and change, and we're finished.
Excuse me for having to run so
pursuing a natural course.
Right? Natural course. No class until January 6th, we said?
Yes.
January 6th.
Yes. You get back on the evening after the 4th, right?
I am coming back.